So it's all here. The story of our time with the Barco.
That was President Lyndon Baines Johnson upon the dedication of his presidential library in 1971. Since then, the library has played host to the biggest names and best minds of our day, who have helped to tell the story of our times through candid, revealing conversations with the Barkoff. This podcast delivers them straight to you. Welcome to With the Barkoff. I'm Mark Updegrove. In today's episode, we take a look at the presidential election in November that will pit President Donald Trump and Vice President Mike Pence against Democratic challengers Joe Biden and his newly announced running mate Kamala Harris. Joining us to offer their perspectives are two highly respected political analysts. Victoria DeFrancesco Soto, a contributor to MSNBC, is the Assistant Dean for Engagement and a lecturer at the LBJ School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas at Austin. And Julian Zelizer, a contributor to CNN, is a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University and the author of 19 books on American political history, including his latest, Burning Down the House, The Fall of a Speaker, and The Rise of the New Republican Party. Julian Zelizer, Vicky Soto, welcome to With the Barkoff. We're delighted to have you today.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks so much.
Well, there's an election coming up. It's been in all the papers. And in so many ways, this presidential election will be anomalous. COVID-19, meaning there will be a virtual environment for both the conventions and the debates, racial strife, economic hardship. I'm wondering, historically, what is the closest we've seen to what we will see in the presidential election in 2020? And Vicky, we'll start with you.
I think when we saw LBJ, the namesake of our school, come into office, obviously there was not an election when he officially stepped into office, but the moment of crisis that the nation was in, where they saw a sitting president being assassinated. And you had this moment that had also been at this point where you had the culmination of the second women's movement. You had the culmination of the Black rights movement. You had the culmination of Latinos previously concentrated in the now present day Southwest. All of these different threads coming together. And then with that spark of the assassination of President Kennedy, I think that then when we get to the election of LBJ, we see this historic transformation because there was so much crisis. The narrative is different, though, because it was one more of hope in seeing President LBJ get elected, as opposed to the moment that we're in now. It's saying, all right, there's been a crisis and we have a leader that's leading us towards something better. Whereas I think right now with Trump is there's a crisis and can we get to a leader who has a more positive and optimistic view? And even with, I think, Trump supporters, they'll be the first to say that he's a tough guy, that he's in it about the economy, that he's not about hope and optimism. But I think in terms of the magnitude of change in, you know, relatively recent history, I see the 60s as parallel to the racial strife moment and the moment of crisis.
Hmm. Julian, what do you think the closest historical parallel?
Yeah, I mean, I think 68 is certainly a good one in terms of social movement, tension, and crisis. I think 1932 is another that comes to mind when a lot of the nation feels that the bottom has literally fallen out. In that case, it was a depression as opposed to a pandemic. But a sense where you didn't know in 1932 where things were going. There was a lot of frustration with an incumbent who didn't seem to know how to respond. Herbert Hoover or responded the same way. So that's another comparison. But, you know, the two things that stand out that I can't think of an exact comparison is A, the pandemic, which affects the mechanisms of our democracy, the ability to vote, the ability to campaign and rally, the ability to have a convention, and then the nature of this president. And I tend to avoid saying unprecedented for everything he does. But he is not a kind of president we've seen in the middle of all this crisis. through kind of from spreading disinformation to the kind of chaos he allows and accepts and supports. So it's a mix of different ones, and then the distinct elements of this moment.
So Julian, we see Donald Trump behave as an insurgent. Have we ever seen an insurgent incumbent president?
Oh, have we seen an insurgent? Yeah, I mean, the one person who tried to pull this off, who I would think of a little bit, is Jimmy Carter. You know, he defined himself very much in 1976 as an anti-Washington insurgent, someone who wasn't part of a broken system. And he tried some of that in 1980. It didn't work so well. In the end, you know, he was bogged down by his own position of power and the crises of the Iran hostage crisis and the economy, and the oil crisis that he faced. Reagan did it to some extent in 84, although he did embrace more the role of being the leader of the country and the role of governing. He never totally embraced being part of the Washington system. And so he tried it a bit, but nothing like what we have today. I mean, President Trump is constantly running as an insurgent, even against members of his own administration. It's pretty remarkable how much this defines who he is, even though, again, he is the one in power.
We're seeing polls now that suggest a wide lead for Joe Biden, depending on the poll you look at. But it's a pretty much a double-digit lead wherever you look right now. But we were all burned by being too reliant on polling data in 2016, where we saw a clear lead for Hillary Clinton, who was obviously ultimately defeated by Donald Trump. Vicky, how do we look at the polls, and how do they reflect the views of the electorate? How accurately do they reflect the views of the electorate in your mind?
Right. So I'm going to put on my, you know, kind of behavioralist hat here in terms of looking at polls. We have to be cautious always, and especially in this moment where we've seen a transition in sampling methods, where the traditional, you know, calling at home has moved over to cell phones, and now you have this mix of cell phones and landlines and online surveys. So that in and of itself brings in chaos. I do think that things are better in terms of our reliability with this mixed method polling system that we have today as opposed to 4 or 8 years ago. But I'm very cautious when I look at the polls. And I think when we're looking at Trump in particular, there's the enthusiasm of his base. And in the latest poll that just came out, I don't know if it was the ABC or the Washington Post poll, but it's really interesting that you see this enthusiasm gap, where you see, even though Biden is leading, there is an enthusiasm gap in terms of the very enthusiastic. The Trump supporters are more enthusiastic than the Biden counterparts by about 10 percentage points. Because the very enthusiastic, that's what gets you up off of your couch to go vote. If you're like, yeah, I'm enthusiastic, that's the one where maybe you're going to be staying home. So I think that this is going to be problematic for the Biden campaign, the enthusiasm gap, especially when it intersects with a pandemic. Because as Julian was talking about earlier, this isn't a campaign where people are going out and we're seeing rallies and we're seeing your traditional campaigning. We don't have that usually pumps up the enthusiasm factor. And, you know, the last piece that makes me nervous in terms of reliability is, you know, an area I focus a lot on, which is the Latino electorate. And the Latino electorate is difficult to sample for a variety of reasons: their diversity, their geographic diversity, the sensitivity of the questions, how do you identify them? And that is a measure that we've yet to really get a lock on. So I think for all of those reasons, I'm still very, very cautious about the polls we're seeing. And I think that Biden's numbers might be a bit softer than what we're seeing in the top lines.
I want to come back to Latino voters in a moment, Vicky. But Julian, I want to ask you the same question. How do you view polls? Do you view them a little more dubiously than you might have 4 years ago?
A bit. I mean, I think the lead that Biden has now in late August, it is still significant. And those are not the kinds of numbers any incumbent would want to see. I think they aren't, you know, failing to register large swaths of voters. From what I hear from a lot of pollsters. And in 2016, you know, there were a lot of prognostications that went the wrong way. But in the end, Hillary Clinton won the popular vote, and a lot of the polls registered that. And in the states, in the Electoral College where he lost, it was just very close, which is what the polls said. And all of us and all the analysts said, if it's close, it's probably going to go to Hillary Clinton. So I don't like take 2016 and think it's all wrong. For me, the concern beyond this enthusiasm gap, which I think is really important, is just what this election is going to be. This is not going to be a normal election. And unlike 2016, Donald Trump now has the power of the presidency. And we're seeing a number of flashpoints where the polls could ultimately be dampened for Biden if not everyone can vote, if voting is curtailed in Democratic areas, if you have a massive disinformation campaign in the next few months, as we just saw a taste of with this renewed birther attack on Senator Harris, and even the power of investigation, which the Department of Justice has, I can imagine many worst case scenarios that are not that outlandish to think of, given what we have just seen, that might make those polls not just softer, but not as indicative of how this will all turn out. And I do think if Democrats aren't kind of thinking 10 steps ahead with all of this, they're missing what they're about to face in the next few months.
As political pundits who are called on by leading news organizations, what is your go-to data? Vicky, we'll start with you.
So it starts with reading them all, because I think that you know, it's easy to just go to the Real Clear Politics average and see what's being said there. I think it's important to also, aside from making sure you're scanning all of them, is looking at the state polls, especially those state newspapers. So for example, just today, the Texas Hispanic Federation, I forget what the acronym is, put out a poll that they did specifically looking at, you know, sentiments here in Texas. So I look for those type of polls, the ones that dig into what's happening in the state, because again, this is an election, and every election because of our Electoral College is won because of the states. You know, it doesn't matter who wins the popular vote, as we saw in 2016, and then we've seen before. So I think that it's looking at these states. When it comes to Latino politics, my go-to is Latino Decisions. I find that that has a really good look at Latinos and in terms of their diversity. But yes, I like to go to the individual states whenever possible.
Julian, what do you look at?
I mean, so I'm not a pollster, so my default still remains my knowledge of history and the history books I read, where I'm trying to make sense of what's going on, less with the immediacy of what I read, which other people are better equipped to do, than with the weight of, you know, what does 1968 teach us? What does 2000 in the contested election teach us? I do like to read, I mean, two kinds of journalism that are helpful to me. One, journalism that isn't poll driven. It's more on the ground reporting, old fashioned reporting, which is now competing with the 538 crowd. Just that gets a feel of what's it like on the campaign trail. What's happening in these states? Are there lawn signs or whatever the equivalent is in 220? It does give you a feel still for the temperature of the campaign. And then I do like analytic journalists. One of the ones who is really good is Ron Brownstein, who writes for The Atlantic. He's on CNN. And he really captured a lot of 2016 as it unfolded with the rural vote, the non-educated rural vote. He was talking about this. I would be on air with him, and he was always saying, this is what you need to be focusing on. And boy, he was right on target. And he's someone I read a lot as well.
In addition to that, it's reading on the opposite side of the aisle, right? So I wake up every morning and I do my news scan. And right alongside reading the Washington Post, the New York Times, the next click I make is to Breitbart, to the Drudge Report, obviously the Wall Street Journal. But I think in terms of the non-data-driven temperature, it's seeing what the other side is saying about their own campaign, but also about, you know, the Biden campaign. So I think that's very interesting. And when I'm teaching my students, my policy students, it's, you have to read everything alongside of it. You can't cherry pick.
We're talking about polling data, and recent polling data from NBC News and the Wall Street Journal has Kamala Harris as the only candidate on either major party ticket with a net favorability rating that is positive, remarkably. But in most presidential elections, as you both know, running mates have little effects on the ticket one way or the other. What does Kamala Harris do for the Democratic ticket?
She energizes the ticket. I mean, I still remember the speech that she gave when she announced her candidacy. I mean, throngs and throngs of people. I mean, it seems like ages ago when you'd have those throngs of people together. There was so much energy in her campaign. At the beginning, I still remember the strength of her campaign at that controversial first debate where she really came at Joe Biden. So I think that Kamala brings energy, and she also brings a toughness. It says I'm not afraid of confrontation, which is something that Trump has always branded himself on. So I think that Kamala brings both of those things that in this moment Biden sorely needs. He needs that boost of energy, which she brings, and also that toughness. Even though Biden says he can be tough, she can do a little bit more of that. And ultimately, I think that she also is a critical link to the communities of color, to the African American electorate, to the Latino electorate. Actually, being from California, she has a very close relationship with the Latino community. Her chief of staff, Julie Rodriguez Chavez, is now in the Biden campaign. So I think she serves a critical link for a number of reasons.
Julie, do you think Kamala Harris will make a difference one way or the other to the Biden
campaign? I do. I'm not someone who usually says the VP pick matters. I'm the person saying, calm down, it's not going to do much. But I think it's important. I think given the nature of this campaign, Biden needs help communicating in the next few months. He needs someone who's very savvy on social media, on television, and she is. She really knows how to pack a punch, like in that debate against Biden. I remember when she dropped out of the race, she tweeted instantly something like, "Don't worry, Mr. President, I'll see you at your trial." She understands the nature of that, and that's going to be really important. And two, I do think, you know, it shows Biden is listening. He did listen to the demands of a Democratic electorate that says everything isn't the same. And even if you're the pick for this year, you're the practical pick. We want to see you understand that the party has changed. And she does that, and I think that's will help her bring energy. Finally, she's very disciplined. I mean, you have to be incredibly disciplined if you're facing Donald Trump, because he will throw everything at you. He will distract you. And she's very good, from what I've seen and observed about her, staying on message and developing a focused attack, which can be very effective, and that will help the ticket. So I do think this is going to be a consequential pick, but whether it leads to a victory, I have no idea, but I think she's going to be a key part of the campaign.
Your new book, Julian, Burning Down the House, chronicles the rise of Newt Gingrich, who changed the tenor of the Republican Party. His goal was to demonize the opposition, and as you write in the book, cause constant mayhem. Do you have the rise of Donald Trump without the rise of Newt Gingrich?
No, you don't. And the point of a book like this is to say that Donald Trump is very much the product of a party that's changed over the last few decades and that has embraced this kind of smash mouth, tear down the House and tear down the institution style of partisanship. That is very much what defines Republicans beyond Donald Trump. Trump doesn't survive without Senator McConnell. Trump doesn't survive without his current chief of staff, Mark Meadows, and the Freedom Caucus he came from. Trump doesn't survive without a Republican Party that had been reshaped by Gingrich and Lee Atwater back in the 1980s. That's why his support remains pretty strong within the GOP. That's why he can do what he does without almost any pushback. And that's why the problem goes beyond Trump. I mean, if he is defeated, it will be significant. It will matter. But it doesn't change the nature of the Republican Party. And a President Biden would be facing this day one when he starts to govern.
Vicky, given the proliferation of media and the rise of conservative talk radio and Fox News, was this divisive political climate inevitable?
I believe so. And I believe so because we have become so hyper segmented, right? So it's not just about, you know, that we have the different cable channels that you can watch depending on what your preference is, but these micro channels that we have where people can not just live in their own partisan world, but they can live in this very micro ecosystem where they can feed off of one another and create this reality where extremism can easily grow and flourish. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, to the point that Julian was making earlier about, you know, this isn't Trump alone. This was a team effort. There were folks behind this that allowed for Trump to rise. One of the biggest questions I have is I'm looking at this election, right? We have our different electorates, our women, our minorities, our young folks, our older folks. But the electorate I've become obsessed with is that moderate Republican electorate. You know, we've got John Kasich speaking at the Democratic convention this week. What happens to all of these moderate Republicans who in 2016 talked about how they would have to put clothespins on their nose, 2-3 clothespins, to be able to vote for Trump because they didn't agree with most of the stuff he said, but they believed that he brought a fiscal soundness, and that's why they voted for him. So my question in looking at the upcoming election is, what do these moderate Republicans do? Do they take the clothespins off? Do they take a full smell of their environment? And then does that lead them to either say, this smell is too strong, I'm going to stay home, or I'm going to turn out and vote for Biden? And I think that that's going to be one of the key electorates, in addition to women and persons of color and older folks, younger folks. I'm looking at that moderate Republican and what they're going to do with their clothespin.
Julian, what's your view? What does that moderate Republican do now that he or she might not have done 4 years ago?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I always lean to the side that they either wouldn't vote or they'll end up voting for President Trump again. I don't know how big the groundswell is of people, not independents, but who are actually Republicans who end up either going for Biden or ultimately in mass not supporting the president, which would be incredibly significant. But I don't know. It will depend how each party defines itself. If President Trump is successful at defining Biden and Senator Harris as radical socialists who are the party of AOC, I can imagine a lot of moderate Republicans still going with Trump, believing, look, the stock market has even survived the pandemic. Wealthier Americans are doing better through this pandemic than they were before, which is kind of amazing, and voting their pocketbooks, where Trump does exactly what many Republicans are happy with. So I don't know. I think it's an open question. But again, I still lean that a lot of Republicans, they're not just have clothespins. They can smell everything, and they're still voting Republican.
The last three Democratic presidents, Jimmy Carter, Bill Clinton, and Barack Obama, have been these charismatic figures that overcame a slate of establishment candidates to win the party nomination. Joe Biden is the personification of the Democratic establishment and has been compared to a minivan in terms of the excitement he generates. Vicky, what's the best way for a Joe Biden to win against Donald Trump?
I think the nation is craving a minivan right now. I think the last couple of years have been a race car, a souped up race car with an erratic driver. So I think, you know, yes, he is an establishment figure, but the brand of his reestablishing normalcy, I think, is what clinched the nomination for him. That there's a need for a steady hand. And this is what Joe Biden brings. You know, the revving up of it, I think is the addition of Kamala, where she brings that energy. You know, it's a couple of cool bumper stickers on the minivan, if we go with that metaphor. But I think that that in this particular case, usually folks run on not wanting the same old. This is something that works for him. And at the same time, he has that linkage to the brand of Obama, where mm-hmm. Obama was a moment of change in the country. It was our first Black president. And so Biden still is able to link onto that. And he has done a lot of that. I'm sure we're going to see a lot of that in the campaign. But I think that for right now, sometimes you just have to go with the minivan.
If I could jump, yeah, I mean, please. I think if I can jump in, never has the ability or willingness to govern been such a radical thing. Meaning, President Trump has gone so off the rails in how he's handled specifically the pandemic, obviously all issues, but the pandemic in particular, to have a whole country facing this crisis, which closes schools, costs jobs, creates a huge number of deaths. And to see the kind of lack of governance, which is so essential to who he is, it makes someone like Biden seem fresh in an odd way. Just that he would do things a normal way, that not that he would create normalcy, but he would bring in experts to deal with a pandemic, that he would try to work for some kind of legislation, he would deal in the realm of information. All of that for many people after the last 4 years seems like, wow, boy, that would be pretty profound to have again. So the insurgent president has made the establishment and made traditional governance seem something that is hard to achieve, but incredibly desirable right now. And I think that's essential to some of Biden's appeal.
And somewhat novel after 4 years of I'm borrowing your words from burning down the house, constant mayhem.
No, that's exactly right. And even Senator Harris, that's part of, I think, her appeal. She has experience. This is a ticket with heavy experience. I mean, few candidates other than George H.W. Bush have come to office in the last 4 or 5 decades with the same level of experience as a Joe Biden. And even Bush didn't have that kind of experience on the Hill. And obviously in the Oval Office. So I think that's really important. And Harris is obviously much younger and doesn't have as much, but she has extensive experience in office. And I think it's an experience ticket. It's like Michael Dukakis was running the wrong year in 1988 when he talked about competence. I think competence is really going to matter, especially since the crisis we're in will continue to play out right through the election. So it will be on people's minds. I mean, they'll have to figure out in many places what to do with your kids when you go to vote, if you can even go to vote. That captures in a nutshell why a lot of Americans will turn to the Democrats.
My favorite motto that sums up kind of this election, and I won't take credit for it, was Matthew Dowd, a fellow Austinite here, Politico. He said, 2020 is going to be about make America boring again.
It does.
No offense.
No, it's true.
Boring in a good way.
We tend to look at Black and Latino voters as being monolithic. They're clearly not, Vicky. But how does the Biden-Harris ticket best appeal to those crucial blocks of voters?
Right. So we see diversity both within the minority community. So, it's, you know, differences among African-American, Latino, Asian-American communities, indigenous communities. But with the Latino community, we also see a lot of dimensions of diversity based on race, based on country of origin, based on your story of immigration. So I think that's going to be what is most challenging for the Biden campaign as they're targeting Latinos, because we know that Trump has done a very good job at cultivating the Latino community that came here with a story that was pushed out because of a communist or socialist regime. That's why we see Trump doing phenomenally well among Cuban Americans, extremely well with Venezuelans, with Nicaraguans. So in reaching that electorate, the Biden campaign is going to have to figure out how it relates to, say, the Mexican-American and the Puerto Rican community on its economic platform, which is going to be different than the ones that it relates to with the Cuban-Americans, who may be of a different socioeconomic status. So it's very challenging. And you know, you've got to give credit where credit is due. And Trump has actually done a pretty good job at targeting the Hispanic vote. In 2016, as point of comparison, there was no Latino targeting. There wasn't even a Latino, a Spanish language translation of Trump's webpage. Nothing. This year, we see all the bells and whistles. We see a fancy website. We see a team of folks going out there. Obviously, they're focusing on those groups that I just mentioned, but they're doing the do. Just recently, we saw President Trump put out an executive order of a Latino agenda, bringing folks in. So I think that we need to be very cautious when we assume that Trump has lost the Latino vote. I think that he's got lock on a couple of Latino communities because of his foreign policy platforms. And I also think that he is able to resonate with other folks in terms of his aspirational branding, something that has worked well with him, with other groups, Latinos not being the exception. As I mentioned, that survey here in Texas that was fielded, it had an oversample of Latinos. And here in Texas, 38 or 39% of Latinos said that they were supporting Trump. So there is a lot of diversity among this community, and one that cannot be overlooked, and figure that immigration, if I talk about immigration and I want to be more expansive, that's gonna do it. It's gonna be a lot more nuanced. And quite frankly, I think that the Biden campaign has a lot of catch-up work to do.
Julian, at the end of the day, what will be the deciding factor in this election?
That Trump, how much animosity there is toward him. I think that's going to decide this. I mean, I think with
is
every
it a referendum, is it a referendum?
It's a referendum on him. And I think there's a lot. I think it's a really important point that there's a lot that Biden, the Democratic ticket, needs to do. It needs to be careful not to assume. It needs to be careful not to take constituencies for granted and to understand the kinds of divisions that exist. But in the end, it will be a question of, can you tolerate four more years of President Trump? And if the Electoral College has enough people who says yes, that's going to be what this election is about. And if Democrats can make the case that it is truly catastrophic to go through four more years of this, I think that will be enough to maintain enough of the lead that Biden enjoys right now. They'll be able to capture where he is today and take that through November. But it's going to be hard for all the reasons we've discussed, and they're going to have to keep that message front and center. It will not be a campaign about if you love Joe Biden. It's just never going to be that. I just think that's an impossible hill for Democrats to climb. But you can win. Are you better 4 years? Are you better off than you were 4 years ago? You know, as a lot of Americans hear that question through their computer in their house with their family, not knowing what comes next, a lot of people are going to be saying no, and that's what Democrats can win on.
What do you think the deciding factor will be, Vicky?
It's going to be turnout. I think that there is a lot of frustration at President Trump on both sides of the aisle. Obviously, his base will always be there to support him, but other folks may not necessarily be there for him. But that's all well and good. So when the pollsters ask you, say, "No, I'm going to vote for Biden. I don't support Trump anymore." But are you going to go out and vote, or are you going to be able to send in your mail-in ballot? Let's assume that we can. So are the folks going to have the enthusiasm? So for me, it always comes back to the enthusiasm. Are you going to cast that vote, or are you going to say, "Well, you know what? It's another 4 years. I'll deal with it. We got through this. Let's just go with it." So it's turnout, and it's figuring out if you can take another 4 years.
I mean, let me add and build on that. It's the mechanisms of the election which matter this year more than any other that I have definitely followed. And, you know, we're in a moment where there has been a fundamental reversal of what Lyndon Johnson and the Democratic Congress accomplished in 65, where they pushed legislation through that strengthened the right to vote with the Voting Rights Act. And we have been in a moment before the pandemic where we've seen that eroded as a result of voting restrictions in many states that make that harder. And now we're layering onto this a pandemic where there's basically a health tax to voting in person, where you have to basically accept that risk if it's even possible. And we're not seeing, we're seeing momentum on mail-in voting, but not enough. And it's not clear we have the money and the resources because the federal government is not moving on this to make it possible for states to do all this smoothly. And so in addition to turnout or enthusiasm and referendum, it's just the basic mechanisms of our democracy, the vote. I don't know how this is going to play out in November. And I think that'll be a big part, whether a lot of people could vote or a small number on who wins.
Julian, if Donald Trump is defeated in November and leaves office in January, what does history say about Donald John Trump, the 45th president of the United States?
Well, one-term presidents certainly just in any case are often not looked on that favorably, although often they're remade in history. But I don't think historians, there'll be a period where they look back and remake what President Trump did. I mean, he just tore down so many institutions and destabilized our democracy in so many fundamental ways. I don't think this is a debate, really. I think it will be very clear if you've studied presidencies why this went so off the rails. And assuming the pandemic kind of stays about where it is through November, I don't see a way you judge this as a policy success. This is a policy failure of epic proportions. This is the Hoover Great Depression, even worse, because in many ways, the administration is making the crisis worse through its action. So I don't think this is going to be looked at favorably, other than some marginal voices in the profession.
Vicky, I'll give you the last word. Put on your historian's hat for a moment. What does history say about one-term president, if that's the case, Donald John Trump?
I think for this president in particular, it's about the last obstacle to the change of a nation. So what I saw in the election of President Trump was a digging in of the heels for white America, conservative white Americans saying, we see the change around us and we're just going to pretend it's not happening and dig in our heels and bring in a person who can keep that change at bay. But change, demographic change, is happening. You even if you were to shut down immigration completely, which we've pretty much done, our persons of color are still going to keep having babies. Latinos have the highest rate of childbirth in this country. This country is changing. Texas, where we are, already is a majority minority state. So I think that in Trump leaving office, we're going to see that the growing pain of the nation of becoming more diverse will be entering its next chapter. We've had those growing pains before. We had it with Southern and Eastern Europeans. Now we're having it again with Latinos, with folks from Africa. So I think for me, it's saying that this one-term president was an indication of a past vision of who we were as a country, and now we're starting to remake a new vision.
My thanks to Victoria Soto and Julian Zelizer, to our sponsors, St. David's Healthcare and the Moody Foundation. And thanks to you for joining us. You can purchase a signed copy of Julian Zelizer's book, Burning Down the House, The Fall of a Speaker and the Rise of the New Republican Party, or any of the books covered in previous episodes through our online store at lbjstore.com. If you've enjoyed this episode, subscribe, rate, and review us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. I'm Mark Updegrove. See you next time.